Maybe years ago, some of you saw copies of the Left Behind series of books, or you read them recently, or somebody gave them to you, or whatever. They were done by Tim LaHaye, who started out as a local pastor here in the San Diego area, and went on to do political things, but he always had a love of prophecy, and especially the book of Revelation. So he was able to put a lot of how he interpreted Revelation into this book series called the Left Behind series. Extremely well known. It's really popular. And so we want to turn today to the kind of literature that he was using as his inspiration, which was in this case Revelation. But we're not talking just Revelation. We're talking about this whole genre of writing called apocalyptic or visionary literature. By the way, let's not confuse apocalyptic with apocryphal. They sound so much alike. And the booklet that I have that goes with my class discusses this in more detail. But apocryphal has to do with hidden or not genuine. So anything called apocryphal means something hidden, something not absolutely genuine article. And apocalyptic refers to just the opposite. Apocryphal is hidden. Apocalyptic means revealed or uncovered. And so when we talk about visionary literature or apocalyptic literature, we're talking about something that, in a sense, peeks behind the curtain of this world, of this life, and either shows us some sort of alternate reality or maybe a view of the future. So I find it really fascinating material. Keep in mind, this was popular in the ancient world. This is not something that's exclusively to the writer John in Revelation. It's throughout the Bible, and it was throughout other places in the ancient world. So this is a style. This is a way to write. This is not just somebody having a fevered imagination or having some strange vision. This is a way to write, and certain things are expected to happen in there, in the writing itself. And so we're going to be looking at that. I think one way to approach it is to have you consider that it's much like science fiction. Now that sounds odd considering this is written so long ago, but it's true. Science fiction turns our world upside down, doesn't it? It presents things that are not happening right now or not the way we expected. It may be a comet that comes and crashes into the earth. It may be a disease that wipes out a large population. It may be a alien race that comes in that we weren't anticipating. But it's the unusual breaking through into our reality. The other way I'd like you to think about it is it's somewhat like political cartoons. And I say that because a political cartoon has symbolism abounding, doesn't it? We recognize the symbols for the United States as Uncle Sam. We recognize, at least in the old days, they had the bulldog was England, the bear was Russia, and there are certain symbolic elements that everybody was comfortable with. And so I want you to think about that. A little bit of science fiction, a little bit of political cartooning going on here. I would say certainly this sort of literature makes us uncomfortable today because we're not used to it as a style of writing, but people in those time, ancient times, were used to this. Well, I said it's in the Bible. I'd like to take you on a quick tour of apocalyptic literature, even in the Old Testament, and then we will, of course, look, spend a little bit more time in the New Testament. But if we take the book of Isaiah, let me take you to Isaiah 24 to 27, those chapters. I'm just going to read the first part of Isaiah 24. I'm starting in chapter 1, Isaiah 24. See, the Lord is going to lay waste the earth and devastate it. He will ruin its face and scatter its inhabitants. It will be the same for priest as for people, for master as for servant, for mistress as for maid, for seller as for buyer, for borrower as for lender, for debtor as for creditor. The earth will be completely laid waste and totally plundered. The Lord has spoken this word. The earth dries up and withers. The world languishes and withers. The exalted of the earth languish. The earth is defiled by its people. They've disobeyed the laws. So he talks about all the things they've done wrong. Let's pick up in the second half of 6. Therefore, earth's inhabitants are burned up, and very few are left. The new wine dries up, and the vine withers. All the merrymakers groan. The gaiety of the tambourines is stilled. The noise of the revelers has stopped. The joyful harp is silent. No longer do they drink wine with a song. The beer is bitter to its drinkers. The ruined city lies desolate. The entrance to every house is barred. In the streets they cry out for wine. All joy turns to gloom. All gaiety is banished from the earth. The city is left in ruins. Its gate is battered to pieces. So it will be on the earth and among the nations, as when an olive tree is beaten, or as when gleanings are left after the grape harvest. Do you hear little echoes of science fiction in there? The ruined city lies desolate. The entrance to every house is barred. People, their lives are turned upside down. The things that they counted on, they can no longer count on. I can almost see a camera panning through the ruined city there, where there should be bustling, a bustling marketplace and vendors and all that stuff, but that's all gone. It's all changed. So the world is turned upside down at this point. Let's go to Ezekiel. Ezekiel 38 and 39. You read a little bit of Ezekiel. We talked about it before with the Valley of the Dry Bones, but if you look, for example, let's take chapter 39. Prophesy against Gog. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. I am against you, O Gog, chief priests of Meshach and Tubal. I'll turn you around and drag you along. I'll bring you from the far north and send you against the mountains of Israel. Then I will strike your bow from your left hand and make your arrows drop from your right hand. On the mountains of Israel you will fall, you and all your troops, and the nations with you. I'll give you as food to all kinds of carrion birds and to the wild animals. You will fall in the open field, for I have spoken, declares the Sovereign Lord. I will send fire on Magog and on those who live in safety in the coastlands, and they will know that I am the Lord. I'm going to skip down to verse 9. Then those who live in the towns of Israel go out and use the weapons for fuel and burn them up, the small and large shields, the bows and arrows, the war clubs and spears. For 7 years they will use them for fuel. So a huge battle is going to take place. You may have heard of Armageddon. This is a referencing of probably the Battle of Armageddon here. And do you hear that? The nations are coming against Israel, and there's going to be this titanic battle, and fire will be sent down. It's going to be an amazing thing to see, according to Ezekiel. Again, do you hear the science fiction elements? Can you imagine huge warfare like this? Of course, the book of Daniel, full of visionary literature. We're going to skip over that because we did spend some time on it already. Let me take you a little further along, though, the book of Joel, one of the minor prophets. Chapter 2 of Joel. Blow the trumpet in Zion. Sound the alarm on my holy hill. Let all who live in the land tremble, for the day of the Lord is coming. It is close at hand, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and blackness. Like dawn spreading across the mountains, a large and mighty army comes, such as never was of old, nor ever will be in ages to come. Before them fire devours, behind them a flame blazes. Before them the land is like the Garden of Eden, behind them a desert waste, nothing escapes them. They have the appearance of horses, they gallop along like cavalry, with a noise like that of chariots. They leap over the mountaintops like a crackling fire, consuming stubble, like a mighty army drawn up for battle. At the sight of them nations are in anguish, every face turns pale. They charge like warriors. They scale walls like soldiers. Does this sound a little bit to you like some alien, some kind of extraterrestrial army? It's like all the armies of Earth cannot stand up to these beings that come in, and they just overwhelm everything. It's like the unstoppable force. So again, I always think of science fiction when I hear things like that. Let's go to 8. Let's see, Zechariah 9 through 14, another section of the Bible devoted to visionary literature. Let me take as an example here chapter 12 of Zechariah, verse 10. I'm starting on 10. I'll pour out on the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of grace and supplication. They will look on me, the one they have pierced, and they will mourn for him. Verse 11, on that day the weeping in Jerusalem will be great. Verse 12, the land will mourn. Let's go down to chapter 14. The day of the Lord is coming. Your plunder will be divided among you. I will gather all the nations to Jerusalem to fight against it. The city will be captured, the houses ransacked, and the women raped. Half of the city will go into exile, but the rest of the people will not be taken from the city. Then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. On that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, east of Jerusalem, and the Mount of Olives will be split in two from east to west, forming a great valley, with half of the mountain moving north and half moving south. You will flee by my mountain valley, for it will extend to Azel. You will flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah. Verse 6, on that day there will be no light, no cold or frost. It will be a unique day, without daytime or nighttime. So do you hear the nature is being changed here? This is huge. This is something, again, panorama, kind of science fiction view here. Have you ever seen a science fiction movie in which key features of the earth are uprooted, great earthquakes take place, cities disappear, all sorts of tremendous travail? This is what we get in these Old Testament passages here. Let's go to the New Testament. Let's take a famous passage in which Jesus was asked when things would take place at the end of time, at the end of the age. And he said things like this. I'm in Matthew 24, verse 15. So when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation spoken of through the prophet Daniel, of course that was apocalyptic as well, let the reader understand, and let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let no one on the roof of his house go down to take anything out of the house. Let no one in the field go back to get his cloak. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. Pray that your flight will not take place in winter on the Sabbath, for then there will be great distress, unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again. If those days had not been cut short, no one would survive, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. At that time, if anyone says to you, look, here's the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it, for false Christs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and miracles to deceive even the elect, if that were possible. So you can hear again, something huge is happening. People have to flee their homes. Trouble is afoot here. And of course, the book of Revelation has a lot of this. We'll look at a few places in Revelation later, but at least those are some of the places in the Bible you can turn to and look at regarding apocalyptic visionary literature. And by the way, since I'm mentioning Revelation, we'll be touching on it several times. Here's a quick note just for you to think about. People always scratch their heads. They read books. They go to seminars put on by people that tell them this is what Revelation means. I would just put a big caution sign up there, because I used to think I knew Revelation better than I do now. I'm to the point where I just let these other people talk about it. But let me tell you, there are three ways that people have interpreted Revelation over the years. One, which is the most popular one now that I'm sure a lot of you have heard of, is the idea that it all describes future events. So when they talk about the Antichrist, for example, you get these people that start looking around the world today, and who is it? At one time, somebody suggested John Kennedy because he had the head wound that was mentioned in Revelation. Of course, that didn't take place. Before then, it was Adolf Hitler. Somebody once said, wait a minute, Antichrist is 666. So if you take Ronald Wilson Reagan, six letters, six letters, six letters, there you go. That must be the Antichrist. So you do have that group of people, and that would include Tim LaHaye. It would include Hal Lindsey. It would include Chuck Missler and some other preachers and speakers who make a lot of money talking about this. For heaven's sakes, Hal Lindsey put out a book in the 1970s called The Late Great Planet Earth. It was the best-selling book of that decade. And so these people see it as a look at the future. And so they're trying to figure out, where are the nations now? How are they interpreting the nations with the verses that they find in Zechariah or Ezekiel or whatever? Then you got a second group. So that's one group that's the future view. That's the one that's probably the most popular right now, but there's one that's coming on strong that's called the preterist view, P-R-E-T-E-R-I-S-T, preterist view. Their view is that most, if not all, of these passages have already happened. Now, how is that? What are they talking about? It sounds like this tremendous day of judgment and this tremendous upheaval and armies moving and this Antichrist out there in the world. Well, they can make a pretty good case for, here's an example. They'll take 666 and they'll say that in ancient times, in the Jewish tradition as well as other cultures, those the letters of the alphabet had certain numerical qualities as well. You know, for example, in our alphabet, we could say A represents 1, B equals 2, C equals 3. Well, they have their own system, and they say that if you take the names for Nero, it's like Caesar something Nero. He has three names. If you add those all up, they end up 666. And so, why Nero? Because that was the time of great persecution for the Christians. Well, why the Roman Empire? Why that time period? What kind of judgment happened then? Well, you probably know by now, if I've mentioned it more than once, but in 70 AD, the Romans came down because of an uprising and just took Jerusalem apart. They first surrounded the city and put a siege there and went around the rest of the country. Eventually, Jerusalem fell. There was tremendous slaughter. People estimate something like 1 million individuals died during that siege and the resulting battle. The Romans tore the temple apart. I mean, this was the worst thing that had ever happened to the Jewish people, ever. And so some people believe that those comments in Revelation and the comments in the Old Testament were all talking about this coming huge Roman Empire that came and crushed the Jews. So that's the second view. So we have the future view, we have the preterist view. A third view is a group of people that say Revelation is just symbolic. It's just symbolic. It's just the triumph of good over evil, and it's all fictional as far as the actual events taking place. So I'll let you decide and let you play around with it sometime. You could lose yourself. You could spend years in looking at all of this material. But what's the key point? Let's just talk visionary literature in general. What's the key point to this? Why are they doing what they're doing? Well, first of all, it's literature of the oppressed. Did you notice that when Ezekiel wrote, where were the children of Israel? In bondage. They've been taken out of the land. The same with Joel, the same with Zechariah. How about Matthew? Well, they're under the thumb of the Romans. Same with Revelation. The Romans have come and just devastated the land. So this literature says things are miserable right now, but someday God is coming back and he will set things right. So it offers hope to people. So it's literature for the oppressed. Secondly, it's a lot like allegories or political cartoons. A lot of images are used to represent rulers and kingdoms and attitudes. We'll see there's a whore of Babylon and there's a dragon in the sky, and a lot of images are being used. So just think of them as allegories. Third thing is there's an eternal message here that's being given, which is stand firm. Yes, things look terrible now, but they're going to get better later. Okay, let's do this. Let's talk next about the elements, the style, because I said this is a style of writing. It's an actual way of writing. This is not one person's fevered dreams, but it's an expected style of writing. So here's number one. One thing that you can expect when you read this sort of apocalyptic visionary literature is the transformation of what's known to what's unknown. So if we take Isaiah, I'm going to go to Isaiah 32. It's what you're comfortable with, and then it's not so comfortable. Here we go. Chapter 32 of Isaiah, I'm picking up in verse 9. You women who are so complacent, rise up and listen to me. You daughters who feel secure, hear what I have to say. In little more than a year, you who feel secure will tremble. The grape harvest will fail, and the harvest of fruit will not come. Pick up verse 12. A land is going to be overgrown with thorns and briars. The fortress, in verse 14, will be abandoned. The noisy city deserted. Citadel and watchtower will become a wasteland forever. The delight of donkeys, a pasture for flocks. And so do you hear that all these things that people were expecting to always stay the same, there's always going to be a city here and there will always be enough food and all. No. It's going to change. It's going to flip upside down. So what you're comfortable with, don't be comfortable anymore. And again, that to me sounds very much like science fiction, breaking into this world. Second thing, I'm going to stay in Isaiah. I'm going to go back to Isaiah 6. So we have a transformation of what we are used to into the unknown. Secondly is, the supernatural world plays a role here. So Isaiah 6. We read this before, so I won't spend much time, but Isaiah has a vision of God seated on a throne with seraphs, and they're flying around. They're saying, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of His glory." And it says, at the sound of their voices, the doorposts and thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke, and they bring a live coal to him, one of the seraphs. So you're seeing a supernatural world. Again, the idea of the curtain being pulled back, and you're getting a peek into a whole different world. Same with Ezekiel. Do you remember the wheels within wheels? And then if we go back to Revelation, I told you we'd do a little bit of Revelation here. Revelation 4 is John looking up into heaven. It says there is a door, chapter 4 of Revelation, a door standing open in heaven. So he's peeking through the door. And a voice says, "Come up here." And it says, "Before me was a throne, and somebody is sitting on it, and they have an appearance of jasper and carnelian, and there's a rainbow encircling the throne." We get other thrones with elders and how they're dressed, and there's flashes of lightning and rumbles and peal of thunder, and seven spirits of God, and then four living creatures. And Isaiah and Ezekiel mentioned those creatures as well. So again, this is not John coming up with something brand new. He is echoing, he is reflecting, he is bringing the threads of Ezekiel and Isaiah up here as well. So there we go. The supernatural world is being revealed. So it's a transformation of what we know and are comfortable with to what we're not comfortable with. The supernatural world is breaking through here. There's a cosmic scope. This is number three. There's a cosmic scope. This is not just one small area that's affected. It's the entire earth, the whole globe. It's all of the heavens. This is huge. This is a setting that's the biggest setting possible. It's the universe is the setting. The stars are involved. I mean, just incredible. So how about the fourth one? So we got known to unknown, supernatural world, cosmic scope. We get some awfully strange characters that interrupt the stories here. Let's go to 12th chapter of Revelation. What's going on up here? So we get a sign appearing in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun. She's pregnant, about to give birth. And in verse 3, then another sign appeared, an enormous red dragon. His tail sweeps a third of the stars out of the sky and flings them to the earth. He stands in front of the woman. He's going to devour the child, and she gives birth and has to run away, and the dragon is chasing after her. So we get dragons in here. If you stay in Revelation and go over to chapter 4, verse 8, we get these four living creatures. They have wings. They have eyes. One looks like a lion. One looks like an ox. One looks like a man. One looks like an eagle. People have done all sorts of games with that one, trying to figure out symbolically why those four particular animals. So I'll just leave that alone. But strange characters there. Stay in Revelation. Go over to chapter 6, verse 4. We get all of these horsemen coming. Another horse comes out. First it's a white horse, and then it's a second horse is a fiery red one, then a third one, and then a fourth one. So maybe you've heard that expression of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. There are the four horsemen coming. So we get interesting character there. You can look in, I won't take the time, but you can look in Zechariah 5:9 and Daniel 7:4. More strange characters. And then finally, a fifth characteristic is nature takes place and gets involved and actually becomes an actor in these stories. If you go to Isaiah 13, the stars, let me pick up in verse 9, Isaiah 13:9. See, the day of the Lord is coming. And what's going to happen? Verse 10, the stars of heaven and their constellations will not show their light. The rising sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. So nature is taking part in this. If you stay in Isaiah, let's look at chapter 8, verses 5 to 8. The Lord speaks, and it says, the Lord is about to bring the floodwaters, in verse 7, of the river, that'd be the Euphrates, the king of Assyria, with his pomp. It will overflow all its channels, run over all its banks, and sweep on into Judah. Now that's incredibly far away, if you look at your map, swirling over it, passing through it, and reaching up to the neck. So we got the rivers, we got the heavens. If we go back to Revelation, let's look at Revelation 12. Revelation 12, 14. So the dragon, remember the story of the dragon and pursuing the woman? Verse 14, the woman was given the two wings of a great eagle so she could fly to a place prepared for her in the desert. So she's getting out of the way. But then the serpent, trying to reach her in verse 15, spews water like a river. But verse 16, the earth helps this woman by opening its mouth and swallowing the river that the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. So the river just simply opens up like a major crack of the earth and all this water pours down into it. So there you go. Those are at least five things that you can look for against that you realize this is not strange, frantic visions of some kind. These are characteristics. These are the elements that you can expect when you do read visionary writings. Transformation of the known to the unknown, the supernatural, the cosmic scope of the setting, the unique, odd characters that you encounter, and the fact that nature itself participates. Well, something else you may want to think about as you read this, you're not going to read a nice, neat, developing story. First this, then this, then something else. So it's not terribly linear. Instead, you get something that always keeps you off balance. It's shifting. It's one to something else that's unexpected. Almost like a kaleidoscope. You ever had an old kaleidoscope and you turn the barrel of it and you get these patterns, and one pattern, another pattern, and it's not predictable. So there's no smooth narrative here. Highly symbolic language. If we look at, I've already mentioned that, but let's just take a look at chapter 7 in Revelation. Another angel comes up and it has a seal of the living God, and it calls out to these four angels. And then we get these tribes being sealed. Now, are they literal tribes or symbolic? A little hard to tell. But we can go through here. We have seals. We have the scroll and a lamb. Chapter 5, a lamb comes out. It has seven horns, seven eyes, seven spirits. Obviously, symbolic numbers happening there. So I won't take the time again to go through that, but I just wanted you to think about the symbolism. It'd really be good. Again, study Bible, always helpful to have. Daniel 2, 31 to 45, very symbolic. Zechariah 3, 3 through 5, very symbolic. So take a look and think about the symbolism. Now, why would people use this? Well, we've already talked about it. It's a literature for the oppressed. But I would say this is the same thing that you could answer when you talk about why science fiction. And that is, well, there are several answers. One is, it's very imaginative writing. I think it's liberating. It frees us from being stuck in a rut, which is good, but something else that's probably not as comfortable is it's an attempt to shake us out of our complacency. We wake up every day and we assume each day will be pretty much like the day previous to that. And both science fiction and apocalyptic writing says, oh no, no, no. God is out there, as far as apocalyptic writing goes. God is out there. He can and he will intervene anytime he wishes. And so for some people, that's a comforting idea, and for others, not so comforting. It certainly is revolutionary writing. It's subversive writing, in the sense to subvert our ways of just going along one day after another, and it opens up all sorts of possibilities. It's a bigger, more interesting, more complex, and maybe in some ways a more frightening world than we thought, because it does have these hidden elements to it that are being revealed in this writing. So I always tell my students, if they're reading Revelation or some other apocalyptic book, not to get all caught up in trying to figure out, so who is this, and what does this mean, and who are these people, and what does this number stand for? I always say, treat it like a ride at Disneyland or Magic Mountain. Just strap in, get that harness on you, and then go for the ride and have a good time and enjoy it. Because it is powerful, it's emotional writing, it's interesting writing. And then someday, you know, if you care, start picking up books to describe it. But just beware, you can just go forever in this. It's a deep, deep set of topics here.